Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. This year, 2017, marks the 500th anniversary of what many scholars consider to be the beginning of the Protestant Reformation, marking this history-changing event from the date which a young Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses in opposition to indulgences to the door of the Wittenberg Cathedral. Over the next few months, leading up to the October 31st anniversary, we plan to feature a number of special episodes examining the events and people central to the Reformation. We invite you to stick with us as we intersperse our regular eclectic mix of topics with a specific focus on 17th century Protestantism. To get us started on this intellectual journey, our first guest in the Protestant Reformation series is Dr. Marion Goldman, a professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Oregon and scholar in residence at the Center for Public Humanities at Portland State University. Professor Goldman earned her PhD at the University of Chicago and has written on a wide range of topics including personal change, social transformation, new religious movements, and the relationship between food and faith. She is the author or co-author of several books including The American Soul Rush, Esalen and the Rise of Spiritual Privilege, Passionate Journeys, Why Successful Women Joined a Cult, Gold Diggers and Silver Miners, Prostitution and Social Life on the Comstock Lode. Oh my. And most recently, Spiritual Virtuosity, Seeking Sanctification, Remaking the World. Coming out in December with Bloomsbury Press, the publishers of the Harry Potter series. And it is also co-authored with my good friend and colleague Steve Pfaff at the University of Washington, demonstrating that ducks and huskies can have a fruitful relationship in spite of our gridiron rivalries. And now, although the book isn't due out till December, you can pre-order copies of Spiritual Virtuosity at Amazon and other retailers. I should note that that book is an expansion of an article that Professors Goldman and Pfaff published in Sociological Theory a few years ago and puts the historical figure of Martin Luther into a new light, challenging some of the notions put forth by another sociologist, Max Weber, who was also interested in that thing called the Protestant Reformation. As always, we will have links to our guest biography, various books, related podcasts, and other neat stuff, including a link where you can pre-order Spiritual Virtuosity over at our website. So get on over there, check it out, and don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and other social media. We'd love to have the company. Mimi, welcome to Research on Religion, and thanks for kicking off our Protestant Reformation series.
I really appreciate your inviting me, and I'm excited to share what Steve and I have discovered through our primary research that kind of dovetailed and led us to this idea of Martin Luther opening up a door not just to personal relationships with God or a higher power, but also social movements that in a few cases consequentially changed both religion and society.
Yeah, the Protestant Reformation is a big one, and Martin Luther really looms large in that one. But before we dig into that book, I was looking at your curriculum vita, and I'm not so much inclined to cite Weber or Luther, but another virtuoso, Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead, who said, what a long, strange trip it's been. I look at this, I said, how does one go from studying prostitution in 19th century Nevada to now writing a book on Martin Luther and Steve Jobs, who, by the way, is also going to be on the cover of your forthcoming book, Spiritual Virtuosity?
Well, the reason it was pure serendipity. My interest was in women and deviance, which is which is why I got into the question of the prostitutes on the Comstock Lode and the social movements surrounding them. And then I was in Oregon looking for a new topic, and Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh appeared on the scene. And in the 1980s, he was huge because he and his followers wanted to take over a county and ultimately create an intentional community of 100,000 in the midst of Central Oregon. And my interest lay primarily in the women who gave up incredibly kind of path-breaking careers in the 80s, lawyers, Vogue models, doctors, to follow Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh to Central Oregon.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, Central Oregon, there's not much there. So you know, to have this social movement all of a sudden appear pretty much out of nowhere really is an interesting, absolutely fascinating academic topic.
Well, it gets, you know, there's this sort of West Coast link to the human potential movement, which is part of what we write about in our book, because it turns out that the human potential movement, particularly Esalen Institute in Big Sur, was a gateway to a huge variety of new religious movements. And Jerry Garcia, to my knowledge, was not associated with Esalen, but a whole lot of people who surrounded the dead were absolutely part of it.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, too. Now, how did you get from studying that to going back to Martin Luther?
The book started at a University of Washington workshop on religion that met every term and included graduate students and faculty. And Steve Pfaff, who'd done a tremendous amount of primary research on the Reformation as a social movement, and my own presentation about the human potential movement had some common themes. And we, you know, the best possible university experience, we began to collaborate on an article, and this led to a connection with Bloomsbury and the book that emerged.
Very, very cool. And it's a very timely book because you do focus a lot on Martin Luther. We also know that Steve Jobs will be on the cover, and we might talk about him a little bit later.
And that's great.
All of this is on the 500th anniversary of Luther basically nailing it to the Catholic Church, as I like to say.
I wish I'd said that.
Well, they still got some copy editing to do, so maybe you can put that in there. I give you permission to use that phrase. But really, this book is more about virtuosity as a factor in social transformation, which makes it interesting. If you're interested in Martin Luther, read this book. If you're interested in learning about social movements and social transformation and this concept of virtuosity, also read this book. But here's the question. This defining concept that you use, spiritual virtuosity, what is it?
Well, great question. I'm going to backtrack a little bit and suggest that the focus on social movements and leadership has been on charismatic leaders who have the power to call up this blind loyalty among followers. And virtuosi who lead social movements are kind of reluctant leaders, because they're interested in their own sanctification. The idea of a unity with a higher power on earth. It is not salvation after death, but how they can connect with a higher power and work toward personal purification and holiness. And they're like virtuosi in other fields. And it was great fun to talk about with Steve, Michael Jordan, Serena Williams, Yo-Yo Ma, and all of the other virtuosi who are talented, dedicated, hardworking. And Max Weber talked about virtuosi as the stereotypical monks who are devoting their lives, or priests who are devoting their lives to sanctification very personally, very quietly. But what we found was that people who are virtuosi in a religious field with religious talents, that is, knowledge of religion, some sort of religious experience and deep faith, the resources, you know, financially to support them, and they can be quite minimal, and some sort of social life can focus on cultivating their virtuosity, and instead of centering their lives and withdrawing from the world, they may feel that they have to serve their ideals by changing it. And usually this is small movements. Often they fail. Occasionally they succeed dramatically. And what Weber talked about, but Luther really emphasized, is that it was possible to become a spiritual virtuoso or work toward that without withdrawing. And he did it in his own life as the leader of a social movement, although a kind of reluctant leader. And you see Steve Jobs, who essentially Luther made Steve Jobs' spirituality possible. It was certainly non-Protestant. It was really centered around variations on Americanized Zen Buddhism. But what Steve Jobs did was develop a householder's path and believe that he was serving his spiritual ideals by bringing technological possibilities and a kind of purity of design to everyone.
Now, that's what you term in the book virtuoso activism. Some of this sounds a little bit like charisma. Some of the people you mentioned, Michael Jordan, Steve Jobs, we think of those people as being very charismatic individuals, but you're careful to differentiate virtuosity or virtuoso-ness from charisma. How do those two things differ?
Well, they're certainly interdependent. And my best example of interdependence was Martin Luther King, who went from being a tremendous virtuoso student of religion to a preacher to a leader of a massive social movement, and he was very charismatic. But the focus of virtuosity is not on leadership, but on sharing. And usually spiritual virtuosi are very reluctant leaders because they want to continue to focus on their own road to purity and holiness. And actually, Steve Jobs was not particularly charismatic in and of himself. However, he had a great PR department. And usually charismatic leaders have that, one way or another, voluntarily or not. And what distinguishes virtuosi is they're really much more humble. They want to share. They believe that their own path to holiness has to involve that kind of bringing a new spirituality to others. But usually they withdraw, and they aren't interested in permanent social movements the way a charismatic leader might be.
So that is really interesting, and you do explore a number of different people in your book, but really the centerpiece is Martin Luther here, the one we're interested as on the podcast, Research on Religion. So let's go ahead and explore the life of Martin Luther. And we'll probably bring up some of his Reformation brethren because these virtuosos tend to clump together, so it seems. Let's examine them through the light of your concept of spiritual virtuosity, that framework there. Many listeners of our podcast know of Martin Luther, but they probably don't know his deep background. So take us back to his early days.
Well, Martin Luther was always thought of as a brilliant student. And his father had high hopes of his becoming a lawyer. And he had moved with his family to a burgeoning city, you know, which is rather small in our terms. It was definitely growing. And his father was very, you know, very successful. And then Luther said, I cannot do this. My calling is religion. And he entered a religious order, and he was so tortured by his own inability to really connect with God that a mentor helped him find another way, which was the appointment as a professor and in a religious university, because at that point all universities were religious. And so he began with this sense of tremendous religious knowledge, and then he had experiences with God, and often he was frightened to death of the devil. He believed the devil was real and living and breathing, but he had tremendous faith and growing faith in the Word, in the Bible, and also a tremendous amount of disillusionment with the Roman Catholic Church. He then had the social support both of a mentor and his family to redefine himself and become a professor. And as a professor, he gathered around him a number of students and supporters who helped implement what we now know as the Protestant Reformation.
Let me pause you right there, and you talk about the influence of his mentor. One of his early mentors was this guy named Johann von Staupitz, who
yes.
kind of has a mystical Catholic bent to him. And Luther is also, you know, thinking and writing around the time of Erasmus. So, and he's a irascible character, so to speak. Tell us a little bit about the influence of these two folks on Luther.
Well, I think Luther's mentor was really important in recognizing his tremendous religious capacities and talents. And he brought him through periods of self-doubt. And when he was in the order, Luther starved himself and engaged in self-flagellation and did everything possible to rid himself of what he believed were sins. But then, when he started studying more, there was a break. And the break really involved the fact that Luther began to see the tremendous corruption within the Roman Catholic Church and the fact that it no longer served everyone. And the intermediaries, the priests and, you know, their bishops and archbishops, what have you, were absolutely venal, or most were. And as he critiqued the Roman Catholic Church, he had to ultimately break with this much-beloved mentor who had really nurtured Luther through the periods of depression and self-doubt and, you know, extreme desire to purify himself without hope that that might actually happen. But then Luther was exposed as a professor to ideas that, you know, that were beginning to come into being in terms of the Enlightenment and the fact that everyone could and should have access to God through knowing and understanding the Word. And he began, I think, to understand this critical point that reading and literacy available to everyone was essential to the ultimate ability to work toward sanctification.
Now, one of the other people that maybe influence is too big of a word, but helped him along, maybe a benefactor or a protector, was a guy named Prince Frederick. And he had a role in getting Luther at this university, Wittenberg University, because he created it, if I'm correct. So what's Prince
yes.
Frederick's role?
Well, Prince Frederick was very important. Many princes supported and sustained men of the cloth, and also, you know, had their own interests at heart in terms of protecting their territories and their sovereignty. And Prince Friedrich had an ambivalent relationship with a number of other princes and also with the Roman Catholic Church. So he was a natural mentor and protector of Luther. And without his protecting him, it's quite likely that Luther would have had a much more difficult time in spreading the word and having the support he needed.
Yeah, a lot of this, you read through the history, a lot of it is serendipity to some extent. Some folks might also think of it as providence, but, you know, the fact that Prince Frederick was there at that moment in time and the printing press and all these other things becomes rather important. What about Wittenberg University? It's sometimes called the Siberia of universities by a few scholars. It wasn't a major university at the time. What role did it play in Luther's formation, and how did he play in transforming that university?
Well, I think it was a Siberia, and Luther was very fortunate to get the appointment. It involved patronage by several mentors. But what happened was his teachings were so compelling. He was not particularly charismatic, but what he said drew people in. And the students at Wittenberg University who had planned to actually become clergy, but there were often no positions available in the church, began to see Luther's and brought him along in these conversations, if you will, workshops, to see and develop a new theology where the intercession of priests was no longer necessary for people to communicate with God. And the critical community within Wittenberg became an essential node for the development of the Reformation. But Wittenberg was also under the protection of people who were sympathetic to that point of view and ambivalent toward the church.
It seems that that might be an environmental characteristic that's really important to the success of some of these virtuosi, in that they're kind of at the fringes of society, not at the far, really extreme fringes, but you know, kind of hanging outside the mainstream. That's, they're still accepted, but they're just on the outside.
I think that's very important. That's really insightful. And what we found is that each of the three major movements that we study and talk about in the book, the Reformation, the anti-slavery movement, and the human potential movement of the 60s and 70s, developed around critical communities, pivotal communities, if you will, where people could support one another. And they had one foot in the mainstream, and they could count on resources from people and support from people within that context. But they also had support for their point of view and advocacy from one another in those pivotal communities.
So he's at Wittenberg. He's preaching to a number of students who are, doesn't look like they might get jobs. So he's got a receptive audience and his kind of radical messages here. One of the surprising things in your book that we talked about, he had seminars of 400 or more students, which, like, that's really big seminar. So I appreciate my, you know, large seminar of 25 now. So, but 400 people is a lot. He starts to develop a new view of sin, or he's evolving in his views of this based upon some of the books of the Bible. Give us a clue of his intellectual formation at this time.
Okay, this is really hard for me because it's not my area of expertise. But I think he came to the recognition, possibly because of his own genuine wrestling with sin, that only God could redeem people. That no matter what they did, you know, so indulgences didn't matter. They could pay priests huge sums of money. It didn't matter. What mattered was someone's relationship to God. Everyone was sinful, and God recognized that. But they could also be saved. And they would not necessarily know, but they would have clues as they studied the Word and essentially followed what God wanted them to do. So sin changed from something that could be somehow compensated for, maybe by good works, maybe by paying money to the church, maybe by pilgrimages, to something that everyone was born into, but that God and the Word could redeem them from. And it wasn't a matter of bargaining or effort. It was simply God's will.
So these ideas start to put him in a head-on collision with a number of individuals within the Catholic Church. And he has run-ins with people like Johann Tetzel, Albert von Brandenburg, Johannes Eck during this period of time. And this leads up to the 95 Theses and Reactions. So this is kind of the next important phase in his development as a spiritual virtuoso. What is going on here with this conflict and with the church?
Well, I think it was building, and he was certainly asked to recant. There were a number of debates. Basically, one of the things that we discuss a little bit, but this is kind of taken for granted, Luther was absolutely brilliant, and he could argue most people into a corner. So the church was pushing and pushing and pushing on him. And in the meantime, there were princes who supported him and others who did not. So it was a combination of a religious and political conflict. The 95 Theses, I think, were a marker, but they weren't necessarily the only time he posted. People, you know how people post notices of seminars or speakers at universities or other places? It was pretty common to post things on churches. Undoubtedly, now there's good historical evidence, the 95 Theses were posted. But basically, they were a symbolic catalyst of a movement that had been percolating as his students and others were becoming more and more dissatisfied with the church. And his students were bringing the new technology of printing to people and teaching them to read the Bible. And the idea that everyone could read the Bible and that everyone could read it in the languages they understood, not Latin, was absolutely revolutionary and kind of grounded the importance of the 95 Theses because they could be read.
I was just going around our university putting up some posters for an event that we'll be having, and I was thinking about this too as I was more or less simultaneously reading that chapter in your book, and I'm like, you know, Luther probably was the only one on the bulletin board, or maybe there was just a few because you didn't have, you know, printing was still pretty expensive at that time. I looked up at the bulletin board I'm trying to put stuff on, and there's like a million things up there, and I said, oh my gosh, that's too hard to get up there. And the other thing that you know too, and speaking to his brilliance, is that Luther was a hymn writer. He wrote a lot of hymnals and or hymns. And later goes on to inspire Bach, which is really kind of interesting. A little fun fact there.
Well, it's kind of interesting, too, because a few virtuosi, and oddly enough, particularly women, use other means to express their spirituality. So you have Hildegard von Bingen, that we talk about, a much earlier figure, well known for her composing. You have someone like Corita Kent, who was a fabulous artist in the 60s and 70s, using her art to express her spirituality. And Luther wanted to write hymns. He did. But it was more of an avocation because he said, my virtuosity is in my ideas and in serving God. And I'm not such a great writer about music. So I think he may have inspired people. But he and others thought that his music really was secondary and part of the new ideas that he was spreading.
Part of his overall genius. Now, these ideas are percolating up, and you mentioned that a lot of these virtuosi are humble or don't really want to be activists. They're interested in sanctification and maybe serving as an example or something. But sometimes they get thrust into this world of activism, this virtuoso activism. This occurs around the Diet of Worms in 1521 and kind of leads to a lot of campus unrest, such as book burnings and all that kind of stuff. So tell us what goes on here and how does Luther's virtuosity change or modify during this period of time?
Well, I think what really modified, there were book burnings on both sides. Luther's followers were burning various Roman Catholic tracts, and there were tremendous, you know, forces building against the Reformation, no question about it. But what happened that was most interesting is Luther began to see himself as a necessary leader. And he began to break with some people, and he really saw his ideas as primary. So, in fact, he didn't want to be a leader on one hand, but if you think that you're the one who knows, and you're absolutely right, you have to assume that mantle. He was also, by the way, as you know, temporarily exiled and protected by Prince Friedrich. So there were all kinds of conflicts going on. But basically, he was thrust to the forefront by his conviction that he could interpret and understand God's word and communicate it to others.
It's very kind of interesting when you think about other virtuosos, such as Steve Jobs, who's on the cover of your book. He was exiled, too, from Apple. And, you know, he had his time in so much the wilderness, so to speak, but then comes back and, you know, almost sees himself as a necessary leader in that regard.
Well, Steve Jobs is really interesting because he was part of the Human Potential Movement. He began his religious quest in high school when he found LSD, and he didn't know how to interpret those experiences. And then he went up to Reed College, only stayed there for, enrolled for about a term, but then he was so smart, people let him stay around, and he was part of a group of religious seekers. And he tried out many things. And in fact, after college, he worked, he was super smart technologically, but not a genius. But he worked at Atari so that he could go on a pilgrimage to India, where he found he didn't have a guru that spoke to him. And he went back to the Bay Area and became involved with the San Francisco Zen Center, and then with an offshoot in Silicon Valley. So Zen became his practice, although he was always drawn to Indian mystics like Yogananda as well. But Steve Jobs really began to see, with the help and, again, the intense nurturing, not unlike Stafford's and Luther, of his mentor, the priest in Palo Alto, that he could implement his beliefs in purity and access to sanctification by virtue of his work. It was a householder's path in the Zen term.
Very, very interesting. Now, you carry this work forward with Martin Luther still hanging around after the big break with the Catholic Church. It really becomes a distinguishable movement separate from the Catholic Church. How does this movement expand, and how does it change? One of the things you argue is that it tends to become a little bit more bureaucratized. What is going on here with Martin Luther, and how does this fit into your virtuosity framework?
Well, I think one of the problems with virtuosi is they're torn between their own sanctification and the idea of sharing the road to sanctification, and deeply believing that their own path to holiness has to involve opening up more access to everyone. So Martin Luther was convinced that he knew the path. And as that developed after the Diet of Worms, you begin to see him splitting with and arguing with other people in his movement. And so he was uncomfortable with mysticism, for example. He grew somewhat anti-Semitic in his later writings. And all of that played a part in schisms within the movement. But basically, he was still, until his death, the figurehead, the symbol. And when he married a nun and had a number of children, one of the common marriage gifts in his part of Germany, and it was relatively small, the common marriage gift was a portrait of Martin Luther and a portrait of his wife to be hung as an exemplary kind of token to support marriage. So he still remained a figurehead. He was still important, but there were splits within the movement. Ultimately, Prince Friedrich couldn't support him. And, you know, he was struggling. And that's inevitable almost, because the costs of becoming a virtuoso leader are very high. And whether or not it's possible to bridge differences within a movement is a big question. So he never withdrew, but in fact, he had to face conflicts and costs.
You know, one of the things that I noticed in the book, too, and I'm wondering, I didn't really quite pick this up in the chapter that you wrote, was that there were a number of other people who could be considered virtuosos or virtuosi at the time as well. These Calvin and Zwingli, Melanchthon, and Osiander, they all kind of pop up around the same time. Is there some kind of dynamic, a synergy that one of these folks creates others or brings them out of the woodwork? You kind of see this in Steve Jobs and Silicon Valley and the like.
You know, I think that virtuosi act as catalysts. And I think that's a distinction between a virtuoso leader and a charismatic leader. The charismatic leader always has to be number one. Luther did not necessarily want to be number one but he wanted to lead, and that was a kind of intense conflict. So I think there are catalysts, and then people within the movement almost inevitably begin to have their own interpretations grounded in the primary message, and they begin to go their own way. And I think the real issue is the social change that occurred that allowed the Reformation to develop, and the fact that different virtuoso leaders could have different patrons and go their own ways.
Speak a little bit to that, because the environment is important. This virtuoso aspect is very important and oftentimes underplayed by scholars, with the normal explanations being these environmental or institutional features of the time. Give us a little flavor for what made that time in history special.
Well, it wasn't just the Reformation. It was also what occurred during the anti-slavery movement and during the Human Potential movement. Is you had a time of possibility with dramatic economic expansion. And of course, you had the German states becoming centers for trade and early mercantile capitalism. You had dramatic technological change. And again, all through the three movements that we look at, in the case of the Reformation, it was printing becoming less and less expensive. And Andrew Pettigrew has a new book about the importance of printing. And that allowed Luther and the people who worked with him to really focus on teaching people to read, making sure the Bible was available in German, not just Latin, and focusing on sermons that were preached facing a crowd. And they were also in German, not in Latin. So the technological change was important. But people were also trying to make sense of their lives. There was geographic mobility in this time of expansion. There was social mobility, but there were also rapid social changes. So the old religious communities that were part of farming villages and very small towns were being broken down as people moved to cities. And then, of course, you had some people getting really, really rich, and those people became resources and patrons for people who wanted to make significant religious and social changes. But the other side of it, and an important side of the coin, is in every case, established religions were weakened by corruption or by simply becoming too, I don't like to use the word secular, but too non-religious. They were no longer speaking to people. And individuals who wanted to make sense of their lives in a religious context were looking for something new.
So that brings up this interesting counterfactual question, the what-if question. That's always fun to play with as scholars. And that is, could, if it wasn't for that time and place, could Martin Luther have forced this movement, let's say, 100 years earlier or 100 years later? Was it this kind of blending of both things? Were both necessary, or what?
Well, I think it was obviously his personal location, you know, particularly in the Siberia of universities, as you pointed out, and his own just extraordinary abilities. But much earlier, I would say 100 years earlier from what I know of the Middle Ages, it wasn't that the Roman Catholic Church was necessarily so strong, but local religions were very strong, nature religions, and they were grounded in particular locations and small communities. So urbanization played a tremendous role in terms of change. I doubt whether the Reformation could have happened earlier, because print was so important, and also the development of urban communities, and most important, the church was breaking down in terms of its hold on people and in terms of increasing corruption within it. And the sale of indulgences, it was becoming a crazy trade where people would, preachers would go, we write about this, from town to town telling everyone they would live in sin unless, you know, and go to hell unless they purchased indulgences from the church. So you had all of this going on, What would have happened 100 years later, I can't say. But 100 years earlier, I don't think it would have been possible because those pieces of the puzzle weren't in place.
Yeah, you have folks like Jan Hus or Wycliffe who were trying to do the same things and probably could be categorized as virtuosi. They never got off the ground for some reason. I guess it took that indulgence bubble, just like our financial crisis bubble recently, to kind of get everything moving, I guess.
Right, and the fact more like people no longer found meaning and value within the Roman Catholic Church. Some did. You know, it wasn't entirely corrupt. Some of the services and music moved ordinary people enormously. But overall, its hold was breaking down because it was no longer personally meaningful. And people were beginning to question whether they needed the priest's intercession to communicate with God.
Now, as this movement rolls along and Luther is living extended period beyond his major break with the church, a tension arises that you talk a little bit about, and the tension between being a spiritual virtuoso and also the need for orderly institutions. During this period of time, his movement that is sought to free itself from the bureaucratization of the church to create a new social movement itself starts to become bureaucratized. And how does this occur, and what are the reactions to this?
Well, I think it's almost inevitable that for an institution to survive, it has to develop an internal organization. And then you have, of course, vying for power and new interpretations and the beginning of splits based on both belief systems but also relationships in terms of that organization. And I think Luther never saw that coming. You know, that he was really concerned with spontaneously spreading the word, making sure that people had the right path to sanctification. And he didn't really think about what would happen as basically there began to be splits, there began to be a need for organization, which he did not necessarily like. And in some cases, he saw the establishment of, quote, Lutheran churches or Protestant churches as anathema to what he was trying to develop in terms of spontaneous personal relationships to God.
Yeah, I think at one point in time in the chapter, you mentioned that he was very uncomfortable with the term Lutheran.
Very.
Yeah, but it stuck for the last 500 years. And there it is.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I, you know, he said he was really uncomfortable, but he wanted to lead. He wanted to lead not in terms of blind subservience, but in terms of having compelling ideas that allowed people to make their relationships with God stronger and better.
In terms of the long-lasting impact of Luther and the concept of spiritual virtuosity, what kind of impact did this have on Christian history? I know we know the history of the Reformation and the conflicts with the church and the wars and all that, but has this concept of Luther as spiritual virtuoso existed throughout history and re-energized it at times?
I think people are writing and thinking about Luther as a person, okay? And so you have a new biography by Lindell Roper, all kinds of things coming out in this very important anniversary year. But I think basically there is still the question of whether intercession is necessary. And what Luther did was open up a door and suggest that people could have direct relationships with God or a higher power. And that basically changed everything. It changed the role of clergy, it theoretically, although it didn't actually, kind of undermined the notion of rigid religious hierarchy and organization. But this lasting idea that a direct relationship with God was both possible and necessary was what spurred virtuosity in other social movements and changed the way people thought about religious life. The issue, though, is it's not necessarily pinned on Luther. In fact, most people don't really recognize that this was something very new in terms of the Reformation and very subversive in terms of the church. But there's still, you know, so I would say Luther is less recognized for that one critical innovation than for the 95 theses that attack corruption within the church. And yet the attack on corruption within the church was really ancillary to his great contribution of the idea that people could have direct relationships with God.
And that is definitely what your book brings out through the process of practicing spiritual virtuosity. Your book is not just about Martin Luther. We already talked a little bit about Steve Jobs and the human potential movement. But what about the other case study that you talk about, the anti-slavery movement? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think the anti-slavery movement, again, emerged at a time that in many ways resembled what Luther had experienced. And the leaders that we chose to look at were absolute virtuosi. They wanted to carry their deep belief in equality for everyone, their religious belief, and translate it into political activism. And we selected Angelina Grimke and Weld, her husband, because they represented virtuosi who gave up everything to lead the movement. They weren't particularly great leaders. They were wonderful speakers, prolific writers. But they realized ultimately that the political forces in the United States, pro and anti-slavery, and the trade-offs that had to be made, did not necessarily correspond with their abilities to inspire. And so they withdrew and carried out their beliefs in a much smaller context after having established a tremendous body of work that fueled the anti-slavery movement. And in each of the cases, we picked virtuosi in these consequential movements to look at the much larger questions of what do virtuosi do, and how do they expand access to the possibilities for sanctification, holiness, and purification on earth?
Really, really fascinating stuff. And in this 500th year anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, this is a fantastic book that really puts the impact of Martin Luther into a context of broader history, which I think is really neat. So we'll look forward when that book does come out. The one question I want to finish up with here, and I always love to ask this of my guests, is to have them do a little bit of a reflection on what they learned over the process of studying this. Has there been anything that surprised you or made you change your mind about how you personally view the world in doing all this research?
Oh, my goodness. I think what it did intellectually, it brought a new appreciation of the ways in which people enact spirituality and a new look at my own personal path in this context. In terms of surprises, my book on the human potential movement was solidly researched. This is the American Soul Rush. But I never realized how much it was the work of someone behind the scenes to kind of put that concept and put those people together until I did research for this book, and how there were many very important virtuosi, and this is true throughout, that have been hidden from history. And we bring some of them out and put it in the new context of the idea that there is continuity, and spiritual virtuosity, when it's enacted against institutions, outside of an institutional framework, is ultimately directed on bringing greater social equality and trying to remake the world as a more equal and just place. Does that sort of answer your question?
It certainly does, and it's kind of a fun way for scholars to think back on what they've done over the course of their years of study. So very interesting stuff. You see a lot of this reflected. You're also, your interaction with Steve Pfaff in the writing of the book too really comes through in the chapters that I've read. So a delightful read, and we will let folks know when it does finally come out. But again, as we mentioned, you can pre-order it. It's a fantastic read from what I have seen now in some of the draft chapters. So I want to thank Miriam Golden for being on Research on Religion. Mimi, thanks for stopping by.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed every minute, and you're the reader I've personally always imagined would be reading my work. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.